Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 28th of October 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode number 54 in our series here where we look at white contributions to civilization and generally take a patriotic look at history. And for the last dozen or so episodes, we've been concentrating on Britain and British history, and we are currently talking about the second King Arthur. And we also have with us today a special guest, once again, Truthvids from truthvids.net. And we also have with us our regular co-host, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, how are you doing? Welcome back to the show. How's life treating you?
Hi, Sven. Yeah, thanks for having me back. I'm good. I'm good, thanks. Just trying to get my home sort of winterproof at the minute, getting some bubble wrap on the windows and duct tape in the seams, you know, just preparing because I don't want to be paying those hefty gas bills.
Yeah, these prices are going through the roof, isn't it? And it is certainly getting colder now, isn't it? The nights are drawing in as well. We've gone over 12 hours dark, 12 hours light. Truthvids, how are you doing? Welcome back to the show. Great to hear from you once again.
Yeah. Great to be here again, Sven. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it is definitely enjoyable having you on the show as well and bringing in your expertise, going alongside Patriarch's expertise and my interest as well. It's great that all three of us are interested in this history and we all bring like a different view to it as well, which I hope listeners enjoy. And what we're going to do today, we're going to begin by repeating some of what we talked about in the last episode, because we were talking about the area that King Arthur II took in Northern Europe. And I said that I would look for more information on where the sources came from for this. And it was difficult to find some sources, but I have. And what we're going to do is we're going to break up the last paragraph that we talked about so that we can expand on what is being talked about there. So we'll start by saying the only portion of France unsubdued by Clovis and his Franks was Brittany, now ruled over by Huel, the cousin and subject of Arthur. And Brittany was basically Armorica. And what Wikipedia has to say about this is towards the end of the 4th century, the Britons of what is now Wales and the southwestern peninsula of Great Britain began to emigrate to Armorica. The history behind such an establishment is unclear, but medieval Breton, Angevin and Welsh sources connect it to a figure known as Conan Meriadoc. Welsh literary sources assert that Conan came to Armorica on the orders of the Roman usurper Magnus Maximus. And they call him a usurper here. It was Magnus Maximus that was the emperor, Magnus Maximus, that was also the British king that was descended from Constantine, and it was his son that was Arthur I. And Magnus Maximus, it says here, he sent some of his British troops to Gaul to enforce his claims and settled them in Armorica, and that was alongside Arthur. This account was supported by the Counts of Anjou, who claimed descent from a Roman soldier expelled from Lower Brittany by Conan on Magnus's orders. Regardless of the truth of this story, Brittonic or British Celtic settlement probably increased during the Anglo-Saxon invasion of Britain in the 5th and the 6th centuries. So, and basically there had been a claim on Brittany for many centuries by that time. And also, as Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett have pointed out, this was at the time of the comet as well. So people were naturally leaving Britain and heading off for Brittany. And when by the time we get to Arthur, he knows that he's safe there, and that is basically his land. It's British land, basically. And that was the only part of France that had been unsubdued by Clovis and his Franks, which also shows that the British that were there were fierce fighters. I mean, they could not be subdued by Clovis, who was quite a powerful king, I think. Truthvids, any views on this?
Yeah, it was common for Roman emperors to... part of the deal when they had troops is that at the end of their reign, if it was 20 years, 25, that they were promised a settlement of land. That, and usually that land, they wouldn't just put you in the middle of a country, you know, surrounded by people you've been fighting. They would tuck you away, in the corner somewhere. And Brittany would fit that description because they would have peace there and rest. There would be aged veterans. And, you know, he'd make sure that they can build their own town and be looked after. And that was a good thing to do, because then future troops and future emperors who wanted troops, would they could use that as an example to say, look, you'll get looked after. Follow me. You know, it's the equivalent of a good retirement fund that we have nowadays, right?
Well, that's you know, it all makes sense when you think about it in that way, doesn't it? Patriarch, any views on this?
Yeah, it's definite. It seems to be definite links with obviously Britons migrating across. I think on the map you showed earlier, there was a region called the Picts or Pictora or something like that.
Pictones.
So I think a lot of peoples from the British Isles were obviously kind of settling elsewhere on in that region.
Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, it says that there was the Pictones there, and that does sound very, very similar to the Picts. Could probably well have been the Picts, and the Venedotii were there as well, and they were allied with the British at the time of Julius Caesar. So there's been a connection there for a long time, and actually the Bretonic language can be understood by Welsh people, the same as the Cornish language. It's all essentially the same language with slightly different dialects to it. Getting back to R.W. Morgan, he says, reviving as the Henrys and Edwards were wont to do in later ages, and what he was referring to there is Edward Longshanks, reviving as they were wont to do in later ages the claims of his predecessors to the Gallic dominions, Arthur, in 5 years, 521 to 526, achieved the conquest of Gaul. Clodomir, the successor of Clovis, falling in the great battle on the plain of Langres. And this is really where we were getting stuck last year looking into this. And it could be that, the claims of his predecessors to the Gallic dominions were in Brittany. They were in Armorica. So it could have been that he took over Armorica. And it says that, and that could have meant, that could have been what he means here by achieving the conquest of Gaul. And then it says, Clodomir, the successor of Clovis, he fell in the great battle on the plains of Langres. And Clodomir, 495 to 524, was the second of the four sons of Clovis I, king of the Franks. And Clodomir was killed in an expedition against the Burgundians. And as we were looking at before this episode, we were looking at the Frankish kingdom, and it was to the northeast of Gaul, and then you had the Burgundians beneath, and then you had Armorica and the Britons to the northwest. And from what I could find out, I couldn't find out who the next king was after Clodomir. It was just telling you about notable kings as much as I could find online. And the next king from the line of Clovis wasn't until 600 AD. So we don't know whether Arthur was made the king at this time. And it's not actually saying that Arthur killed Clodomir. It's just saying that Clodomir was killed. He fell in the great battle on the plain of Langres. And R.W. Morgan is also telling us that Arthur was crowned at Paris the same year that Justinian succeeded to the Eastern Empire. And Paris was just outside of Armorica. And I don't think it was actually within the Frankish kingdom. So, I mean, it could be that Arthur just had Armorica. It could be that Arthur had that whole area apart from the Frankish bit. Or it could be that Arthur actually had the Frankish bit as well, because we can't actually tell who the king was of the Frankish bit at that time. I mean, perhaps you might have some more information on this, Truefids. What do you make of this?
Yeah, when I read the history of the Franks, Clovis, he was obviously the king of the Franks. And that, you know, it was very tribal back then. Every territory was just a certain tribe. And it wasn't only the Franks in what we call France. And Clovis basically just every few years he would launch battle against another territory and claim it under his. But it was just under his dominion, right? And then when he died, back then they didn't just have this. At least the Franks didn't just have this direct one-liner kings, you know, the eldest inherits it all. He instead divided it all between his four sons, and then his sons divided their territory between their sons. So basically you end up with a mass of kingdoms, and some of these kings even just only had a city, right? There was a king of Paris, for example. So it would have been chaos. There would have no doubt been constant, you know, kings raiding other territory, claiming dominion. And then centuries later, when it's written about, you know, such as the history of the Franks, they might have not have had every single king, every single bell, but just written about how it ended up eventually, who reigned. So I could easily see an Arthur coming in if it was only 5 years and then, you know, disappearing. You could see that the history of the Franks might not fully mention him, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is plausible that Arthur could have been crowned in Paris and been king of that area at the time. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Just going back from last week, what we discussed about his kingdom stretched as far as the Eastern Europe, though, didn't it? So he would have likely have taken it.
Well, it says it stretches to the Pyrenees. That's actually in the next part here. The conquests of the mother countries of the pagan nations themselves followed from AD 527 to AD 535, which means Old Saxony, Denmark, Frisia, North Germany, and the whole of Scandinavia as far as Lapland being subdued in succession. So it's all of that north area, basically. And I mean, that might stretch as far as Russia there. I'm not quite certain. Frisia, North Germany, Old Saxony. And Johann Magnus, the Archbishop of Uppsala, the historian of ancient Denmark, charges Arthur with having ruled these northern conquests with excessive rigour. From AD 535 to 541, the Arthurian Empire extended from Russia to the Pyrenees and enjoyed undisturbed repose. So, I mean, really, we want to have a look where the Pyrenees is there. And that's the area that it's been alleged that Arthur ruled. And it's this Johann Magnus that is saying this. He must be getting it from somewhere. So I looked up Johann Magnus. Johann Magnus is a modified form of Jon Magnus, a Latin translation of his birth name, Johann Manson, 1488 to 1544. He was the last functioning Catholic archbishop in Sweden, and also a theologian, a genealogist, and a historian. Magnus spent his time in Venice and Rome, where he wrote two historical works about Sweden, the Historia de Omnibus Scythorum Sunumque Regibus, and Historia Metropolitanae Ecclesia Uppsaliensis, which are important for their historical information, but are also filled with tales that have no reliable foundation. The History of All Kings of Goths and Swedes is a work on Swedish history, which was printed posthumously in Rome in 1554 by Johann's brother Olaus Magnus. Olaus sent it to Sweden, where it was subsequently republished several times. It appeared in a Swedish translation by E.R. Skrodrus for the first time in 1620. And then Wikipedia says it is a very unreliable source for early Swedish history. I mean, how do they know that? I mean, this was republished several times. And if it was inaccurate, surely they wouldn't have published it again. They would have said, well, we don't want to be reading this. This is rubbish. But Johann Magnus made creative use of Jourdain's Getica and of Saxo Grammaticus to depict a history of the Swedish people, of their kings, and of the Goths abroad. And Saxo Grammaticus is responsible for the Book of the Danes, which is a really great, interesting book. It's got lots of morals in there, basically, lots of traditional fables. It gives a really good idea of what the Nordic people were actually like, and that gives the history of Denmark. The first 16 volumes are taken up by the period before AD 1000. In a strange mix of tales from earlier writers and his own fiction, allegedly derived from runic records at Uppsala in the Younger Futark, which he claimed had served the Goths as an alphabet for some two millennia before Christ. Johann Magnus invented a list of kings of Sweden with six Erics before Eric the Victorious, where he started counting from Jourdain's Berig as Eric the First. He also invented six kings of the name Charles before Charles Sverkerson. This is how Gustav I. Vasa's sons could style themselves as Eric the 14th and Charles the 9th. While the work describes these fictional Erics and Charles in generally positive terms, it also includes a few invented tyrants with names similar to Gustav. So how can they say that, you know, this was a false history, there weren't that many Erics? Because you've got an Eric here, which is calling himself Eric the 14th, and surely he must know his family tree. He wasn't just getting it from this history book, and it would have been the family trees where the history book was actually taken from. The work is exceedingly patriotic and suggests that Denmark was populated by convicts exiled from Sweden, a charge drawing a sharp rebuttal from the Danish court. So that's interesting. It says it's exceedingly patriotic, but yet at the same time claims that Denmark was populated by convicts. But I guess this is a Swedish history, isn't it? So they're sort of putting Denmark down there. A milestone in Swedish and European Gothicism, Johan's work proved fundamental in the birth of various declensions of Nordicism, arguing that humankind stemmed from the north and imbuing this cardinal point with powerful political and prophetical meaning. So that's the patriotic side of it. Probably tended to overemphasize Sweden's role in history. And that's the guy that is being quoted here or referenced here by R.W. Morgan. So, I mean, he lived in 1488. So he's actually talking about probably a thousand years after the history was actually there. But surely the people of Sweden must have remembered if they'd been actually taken over by a king called Arthur. I mean, if he'd put that down and it hadn't been true, there wouldn't have been another republication of the book, and people would have said, well, this is just not true, that this isn't our history. Quite clearly, they believed this history, and there must have been evidence to back it up. There must have been family trees to back it up for him to say this. I mean, what do you make of this Johan Magnusson here, Truefitz?
Well, firstly, it's just astonishing that all European history must be made up, right? Everything is just, this must be nonsense. It's unreliable. But then, they'll dig up, allegedly they'll dig something up and claim an entire false British history. They do it all the time, right? They claim that the early British were dark, and that we gradually became white, and that we lived in the Ice Age, but they never present the actual evidence. It's all just made up, right? And here you can see that there was a clear history, and it's logical, right? But I don't know much about this Johannes guy, but if he wrote that Arthur or a king in the Britain in that time ruled over them, then it's certainly possible, right? And I don't think it was necessary that King Arthur had to visit all these places and, you know, conquer them all the way to Russia. They could have just simply acknowledged him as the overlord and gave him some tribute. It was the same with the Huns who came into Europe. They didn't conquer all of Europe outside of the Roman territory. They just used, they just had them under tribute, and then those territories would send troops, and then he would use those troops to invade Rome. It was simple as that. He didn't necessarily have to visit every single place. And you know, that can make it seem unrealistic if you think Arthur went to all the way to Scandinavia, to Germany, to Russia, back to Italy, you know, all within a few years. It didn't necessarily have to be that way, right? I just wanted to stress that point.
Yeah, and I mean, he says he charges Arthur with ruling excessively rigorously. So he must have named Arthur by name as the king that was ruling like that. And also, we've heard before about how kings from Britain went over to Norway to get married, and this was pre-Roman times. We've also got in Denmark, it used to be called the Cymric Chersonese, which obviously has the same root word there, Cymric, as the Cymry. So it came from the Cimmerians. So the people that were originally there were the same as the Cymry that were in Britain. And then they made their way over to Britain as the Danes. So it was the same. It was the same people. And I'm actually remembering that Survive the Jive did an episode. He's a historian. I'm sure most of our listeners have heard of him. I can recall him doing an episode looking at the genes of the Swedish Vikings, and it was from before the Vikings made their way into Britain. And he was confused because it was showing that they had the same genes as the Britons, which of course we know because we say, well, it was the Cimmerians that went to Britain, and they also went to the Cymric Chersonese, which was Denmark. So, and that was before, obviously, the Vikings came to Britain. But he was confused. This was, you know, this was a big enigma to him, that the genes from these third or fourth century, maybe it was earlier in that second century Swedes that were in Sweden, were actually had the same genes as the Britons in Britain at that time. And this is before the mainstream history tells us that the Vikings made their way to Britain. So he was confused by it, but it actually bears out the history that we've been talking about here. Patriarch, any views on this historian or any of what we've been discussing?
Touching on some bits, what Truth had said before about our history and even the prehistoric origins and stuff, like on Wikipedia here, they say, first Homo sapiens settled, replacing some potentially Neanderthals. But there's kind of traces of evidence as well, which suggests we didn't kind of originate from there anyway, such as there's the Carnic stones, which are kind of similar to what you'd find, in the Old Testament, unhewed stone, basically. And, you know, that's a kind of a marker that we kind of culturally came from Mesopotamia and those cultures that would leave marks like that on the, as they traveled about. And then obviously you've got the ancient Vedic language and the runic records, and you know the connections to languages that came from the Middle East, such as the Paleo Hebrew. So I think with the Europeans having traveled so often and kind of like switching and changing different geographical locations through conquest or just migrations, I think our records are probably so much more perplexing than any other race.
Well, it's like they discount people moving about and migrating about. It's like the mainstream sort of narrative is that we evolved from these monkey types that were sort of living in Britain and we just stayed in Britain, and our ancestors must be these humanoid skeletons that we've found that are, I don't know, 20,000 years old or whatever. And that's just, you know, not what our history tells us. And it's not, common sense tells you that, you know, that didn't happen. When you see the earlier civilization is in Mesopotamia, and it's the same Nordic type peoples that are in North Europe today. And that was the first civilization. And then you see that civilization then spreads into the colder and colder areas as history goes on. And Europe became a big civilization after Christ. I mean, that was the last one, but we'd already had 3,000 years of it in the Near East, and peoples move about, especially white people. You know, we're pioneers, we're explorers, we're travelers, and we have this urge to, you know, go to where the sun sets and discover a new land for ourselves. And that's just something that we've always done. And they seem to sort of discount this and say, oh, it's the same people that were always there. You know, it's the Arabs that are in Egypt now. They must have been the ones that built the pyramids, or it must be the Arabs that are in Iraq now. They must have been the ones that built Babylon. Same with India. And it's not. It was white people that moved around. We migrated around exactly the same as today. And the areas that we built these civilizations in, they then became magnets for other peoples. And then mingling between the two would occur. And then instead of it being the original gene type that actually built the civilization, it would be a people that didn't have the ability to maintain it. And then it would fall apart. Or you would have groups that came in from elsewhere that were a different race that were treated as second-class citizens, and eventually there were so many of them that they would rise up and attack the people that built the civilization. And that seems to have been what happened with that early civilization, the Harappa people, I think, from the Harappa Valley. We did an episode on this right at the beginning of this series, where all the statues of the people that actually built the civilization were all smashed up and damaged, and all the bodies that they found have been severely beaten up. And my theory would be that what happened is this second class citizen type that was a different racial type, they must have attacked the other type that built the civilization, because there's no other explanation for why the civilization collapsed. So we see the same thing happening over and over again that we see happening today, where we have this white civilization that's been built in Northern Europe, and it's now being filled up with other peoples from elsewhere in the world. It becomes a magnet for it. We've wandered a little bit off topic here, so we'll get back to King Arthur here and R.W. Morgan. He says, Milan, 2 years before, had been taken by the Goths, and 300,000 of its citizens, every male adult, have been put to the sword by the brutal captors. So I then had a look in Wikipedia, trying to find exactly where this happened in history, and this appears to be it here, around about 538. It says, the real break with Milan's imperial past came in 539 during the Gothic War, where Uriah, a nephew of Witiges, formerly the king of the Italian Ostrogoths, laid Mediolanum to waste with great loss of life. In 538, the Romans landed forces at Genoa and retook Milan at the request of its population. Urias the Goth was tasked with recovering it. However, he besieged the city over the winter of 538 to 539, and when the city capitulated, he allowed his Burgundian allies to seize the women for slaves and his own men to slaughter the male inhabitants because they had requested Roman assistance. In order to liberate Italy and add it to the Christian Empire of Britain, Arthur then conducted his forces again to the continent, leaving his insular dominions under the regency of Mordred, the eldest son of his sister Anna or Morgana, and Llyw Cynfarc Lotho, the King of Scotland. And the name of Mordred stands out in unenviable prominence as that of the third arch-traitor of the Isle of Britain. So I moved into R.W. Morgan then a little bit unexpectedly. What we're really talking about here is what was happening to Milan at this point. So when R.W. Morgan says the Goths took 300,000 of them and put all the males to the sword, I mean, this gets collaborated with by Wikipedia, that says that they slaughtered all the male inhabitants because they have requested Roman assistance. Any thoughts on this, Truefids?
Yeah. Just firstly, I just wanted to say that Denmark used to be called Kimri, right? It actually was named after the Kimmerians originally back then, which shows again that the relationship between the Danes and or the people living there in Britain. But back to this, yeah, this shows you how brutal it was back then. Obviously, the Western Empire had collapsed. So when it says they're asking for aid from the Romans, it means the East Roman Empire, right? And we know that Justinian around this time, he sent his general, I forgot his name, but he then started taking places back. He took the East, North Africa, and then he was trying to take Italy, but they'd never really fully succeeded because Italy was taken away and they never fully reclaimed it, right? But that's basically what's happening. There's this power struggle for Italy once the Western Roman Empire fell. And from then on, Italy just gradually declined, right?
Yeah, also Crimea, that goes back to the Cimmerians as well, and the Cymri. So they would name these places as they made their way through into Europe, into the west of Europe, and places that they had passed through ended up being given their name. Any thoughts on these Goths and the Gothic takeover of Rome, Patriarch?
Not necessarily just the Goths, but just their behavior when it comes to, keeping the women for themselves and then slaughtering the men. I think that's pretty typical, isn't it, of a kind of a tribal takeover. I just wonder, what people's thoughts on the dominance. Is it the male line, kind of the male seed being kind of passed on? And this is kind of a show of kind of takeover, isn't it? And being conquered.
Yeah, it's a show of strength, really. I mean, that was the way that these barbarian tribes would behave. I mean, it's incredible today when you get people that say, "Oh, it's so terrible that white people, what they did to the Red Indians." But the Red Indians attacked them, and for the first time in all of history, instead of saying to the vanquished foe, "Well, you either have to accept death or slavery," which is what happened in the ancient world, we actually gave them reservations. And yet we get attacked for this today. And yet all throughout the ancient world and ancient history, if you went to war against someone and you defeated them, they either fell on their swords and accepted death, or they accepted slavery. There was none of what went on with the Red Indians. There was none of this like, "Oh, well, you can have this land here and we'll let you have your laws there."
True.
They were vanquished. Yeah. They were a vanquished foe.
I guess it's a good point, really, to say that, whatever we did to other races, it's nothing we haven't done to ourselves, is it, really?
No, that's it. We made slaves out of white people as well, particularly in Roman times. Getting back to R.W. Morgan, Arthur had advanced as far as the Alps when intelligence reached him that Mordred had rebelled and, aided by pagan levies, seized the throne. So Mordred is working with pagans, working with the Saxons, I guess. Retracing his march, Arthur defeated the traitor in two engagements at Dover and Winchester. The third and last battle, known as the Three Black Days of Camlann, was fought at Camelford, within a few miles of Tintagel Castle. It lasted 3 days, no less than 100,000 of the chivalry of Britain falling on the fatal field. And I think that's why Tintagel comes in with this Arthur legend, because Camlann they thought was Camelford. And I think when we get to Alan Wilson, he will tell us something different. Arthur himself, sorely wounded, was conveyed by Taliesin, that's the famous bard, Morgana, and others of his court to Avalon. His farewell words to his knights, "I go hence in God's time, and in God's time I shall return," created an invincible belief that God had removed him, like Enoch and Elijah, to paradise, without passing through the gate of death, and that he would, at a certain period, return, reascend the British throne, and subdue the whole world to Christ. The effects of this persuasion were as extraordinary as the persuasion itself, sustaining his countrymen under all reverses, and ultimately enabling them to realise its spirit by placing their own line of the Tudors on the throne. As late as AD 1492, it pervaded both England and Wales. "Of the death of Arthur, men yet have doubt," writes Wenkin de Verd in his chronicle, "and shall have for evermore, for as men say, none wot whether he be alive or dead." The aphanismus, or disappearance of Arthur, is a cardinal event in British history. The pretended discovery of his body and that of his queen, Ginevra, at Glastonbury, was justly ridiculed by the Cymry as a Norman invention. And I think that, again, that was Edward I, Edward Longshanks. These monks dug up this huge body and told him that it was the body of Arthur, because he was such a fan of King Arthur. Arthur has left his name to above 600 localities in Britain. His court at Caerleon was the resort of all the genius and erudition of the age. Amongst its distinguished ornaments may be mentioned St. David, St. Cadog, Merlin Ambrosius, Cluark, Taliesin, Aneurin, Golidan, St. Kentigern, St. Iltyd, etc. The genuine works of Aneurin, his British History and Life of Arthur, are lost. The work of Gildas, which at one time passed for the former, is a forgery of Aldhelm, the Roman Catholic monk of Malmesbury. Some of the poetical compositions of Cluark, Merlin, Taliesin, Aneurin, and Golidan have come down to our own time. So R.W. Morgan thinks that Gildas's history is actually a forgery carried out by a Roman Catholic monk of Malmesbury. And that may be because he didn't mention Arthur. And we've also talked about how it was suggested that Arthur had actually killed one of Gildas's relatives, and that's why he didn't include him in this history. But you can see here that it mentions Taliesin, and Taliesin was the one, I think, that said that the Christianity was a new thing in the East, but there never was a time that the Britons were not following its precepts. I think that was a quote from Taliesin. So his work survived. And as he says here, we have this work of these other authors from that time that was supposedly a part of the court, their poetry, that has managed to pass its way down. And of course, that's all Welsh history. And we also have the prophecies of Merlin, which people would look at carefully, and apparently they all came true. It was all about future kings of Britain. So, Treeford, any thoughts on this and the death of Arthur and what we're talking about here?
Yes, I think what he said, "I go hence in God's time," it was, of course, the time of Christianity, right? And God had come down as a man, so it was now his time, Christ's time. That's what I think he means there. And then, "in God's time, I shall return." Obviously, we know that Christ will return, and that's when everybody is resurrected, and Arthur will return, right, along with everyone else. So that's what I think he's basically saying, right? Because Christianity wasn't everywhere at that point yet, right? There were still pagans in the, a lot of North Europe still. But in Britain, it certainly was God's time, Christianity, as you said. And I think when Arthur died, his subjects tried to hide it. They, for a long time, I think several years, maybe a decade, they still, pretended that he was still alive. And then eventually, that helped build this myth that he had just disappeared, when in reality he had just died from the wounds, right? And they tried to hide it. But it's interesting that, well, he's saying 100,000 people died. That would have really crippled the, you know, the Britons, their power in Britain at that point, right? As a civil war is always devastating. And then, of course, the Angles, Saxons, Jutes came in, and that's when they came to dominate, right?
Yeah, I think Alan Wilson and Baron Brackett have found evidence of this, like all these horseshoes or something that was found in a mound round about where that battle was. And I think it's interesting there where they're trying to link him with Enoch as well, because Enoch apparently was carried up to heaven, didn't actually die, was carried up to heaven, and Elijah. So they're bringing in this biblical narrative to say that Arthur, that's also what happened to Arthur, and he may come back. So it's interesting that they put that there. But as you say, there's this other interpretation of it that you were pointing out there, Truthfeeds Patriarch. Any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I was similar points, really. And I think, you know, with the 100,000 being taken, they probably needed to, kind of ferment a sort of a myth like that to kind of retain their kind of power in a way, or not necessarily power, but fear, because obviously Arthur was a revered man. So, you know, any neighboring tribes that are ready to sink their teeth in might think twice if they feel like he's not dead, and, you know, he's almost kind of like a demigod. So I think maybe that's why they wanted him to kind of live on in a way that, prevented outsiders from swooning in.
Yeah, that's a good point there. Trying to keep up morale, keep up support, keep up on this winning streak, rather than, you know, having your great hero eventually die. Well, next we'll move.
Oh, Sven. Yeah, go on. Also, I wanted to mention, it's funny how King Henry VIII, that would be the return of the Tudor line, right? Well, his father, but it's funny, he wasn't a great king, right? He was the one who introduced usury, and from then on it was all downhill, right, with the merchants gradually taking over. So it shows you it's not just, oh, if it's a British king or a Saxon king or an Angles, it really just is down to the individual, right, and the era. It, we're all the same. We're all from the same people, essentially, right?
Yeah, we're all from the same people. I wasn't aware of that. So Henry VIII was the second of the Tudor kings then?
Yeah, I believe his father, was it Henry VII? I would have to double check. He was the one who fought, was it Richard III? Well, I might be way off. I'd have to double check. But there was this power struggle, and then he managed to take the throne. And then his son, Henry VIII, he became, you know, the guy with the six wives. He took over from his king, from his father.
Well, he was also the one responsible for the Reformation, the looting operation, as Dr. E. Michael Jones calls it, where we smashed up all these old churches and all these fantastic sculptures, the magnificence of the old churches, that was all smashed up, and all the lands was given to the lords. So that the lords made a lot of money out of it. And as you're saying there as well, it sounds like he reversed the law against usury. I mean, they came out with something that was called the Bill Against Usury. And it was actually a bill allowing usury up to 10% so that Christians could become moneylenders, as well as Jews, because Jews were exempt of the Christian law. They followed the Jewish law. And their moneylending, because it had been allowed to go on, it was oppressing the people. So what they said was, well, we'll have to have Christians that can do the same thing. Instead of just banning usury, which is what they should do in the Bible. Yeah, Henry VIII, I think he was a very bad king. So I must admit, I haven't really looked into the Tudors yet. And that's very sad if the moment that, you know, somebody with a Welsh heritage comes back on the throne, and then he legalizes usury and is responsible for the smashing up of all the monasteries and these wonderful old churches that we had. I mean, even Glastonbury, I think that got smashed up. Anything else to add to that before we move into the prophecy of the two dragons?
No, just that it shows you it doesn't matter necessarily what branch of, Britons you're from, Israelites. It really just depends on the character of the man. You can't say, oh, if we just had, a Welsh king, everything would be good, because Henry VIII possibly descended from Arthur, right? And he ended up doing bad things for England.
Good point. Good point there. Well, let's have a look at this prophecy of the two dragons. Geoffrey gives the following account of Merlin's interview with Vortigern and his wise men after they tried to sacrifice him. And this is Geoffrey of Monmouth from in his History of the Kings of England. And what's actually happening here is Vortigern was told, because he was trying to build a castle and he couldn't build the castle, that the rocks would get thrown down at night or whatever. And he was told that what he had to do was find a young boy who, and they didn't know who his father was, and then they had to sacrifice him. Rather a strange story. It's actually told in the Brutes as well, the Chronicle of England, which has a different origin to Geoffrey of Monmouth. So, you know, it really says that Geoffrey of Monmouth was getting his work. He wasn't making his stuff up. He was getting it from earlier works. And I can recall reading this in the Brute, the Chronicles of England, about Merlin. So this is a summary of Geoffrey's account of what happened there and the entry of Merlin into the story. "Who," said the boy, "instructed you to do this?" "My wise men," answered the king. "Order them hither," returned the boy, this being complied with. He thus questioned them, "By what means was it revealed to you that this citadel could not be built unless the spot were sprinkled with my blood? Speak without disguise and declare who discovered me to you." Then turning to the king, "I will soon," said he, "unfold to you everything, but I desire to question your wise men and wish them to disclose to you what is hidden under this pavement." They, acknowledging their ignorance, "There is," said he, "a pool. Come and dig." They did so and found the pool. "Now continue," said he, "tell me what is in it." But they were ashamed and made no reply. "I," said the boy, "can discover it to you. There are two vases in the pool." They examined and found it so. Continuing his questions, "What is in the vases?" They were silent. "There is a tent in them," said the boy. "Separate them, and you shall find it so." This being done by the king's command, there was found in them a folded tent. The boy, going on with his questions, asked the wise men what was in it. But they, not knowing what to reply, "There are," said he, "two serpents, one white and the other red. Unfold the tent." They obeyed, and two sleeping serpents were discovered. "Consider attentively," said the boy, "what they are doing." The serpents began to struggle with each other, and the white one, raising himself up, threw down the other into the middle of the tent, and sometimes drove him to the edge of it, and this was repeated thrice. At length, the red one, apparently the weaker of the two, recovering his strength, expelled the white one from the tent, and the latter, being pursued through the pool by the red one, disappeared. Then, the boy asking the wise men what was signified by this wonderful omen, and they, expressing their ignorance, he said to the king, and then it goes back to the description of this here, it says, "The wise men of Vortigern had no idea of what any of these signs meant, and they could not hide their ignorance. With growing confidence, Merlin told them their meaning, and then made a famous prophecy about the fate of Britain. I will now unfold to you the meaning of this mystery. The pool is the emblem of this world, and the tent that of your kingdom. The two serpents are two dragons. The red serpent is your dragon, but the white serpent is the dragon of the people who occupy several provinces and districts of Britain, even almost from sea to sea at length. However, our people shall rise and drive away the Saxon race from beyond the sea, whence they originally came. But do you depart from this place, where you are not permitted to erect a citadel, I, to whom fate has allotted this mansion, shall remain here, whilst to you it is incumbent to seek other provinces where you may build a fortress." Merlin then explained that the problems with the construction were actually caused by the two sleeping dragons waking up and fighting each other. He explained the red dragon represented the defenders of Britain, which, although exhausted and appearing defeated, would eventually rise up and repulse the white dragon of the invading Anglo-Saxons. He told of the coming of Arthur, who he referred to as the Boar of Cornwall, which would be the emblem on his banner, and prophesied that six kings descended from Arthur would rule before the Anglo-Saxons returned to rule over Britain. Then Merlin told Vortigern that he was not destined to build his fortress on this site. He told him that fate had given him the ownership of the hill and told Vortigern he must seek elsewhere for a suitable site. Vortigern followed Merlin's advice and eventually settled on Carguerthigin, whom some scholars think may be Craig Gwerthin, Llandeisle Dyfed. But it is not proven, and there are several other candidates. This was to be the place Vortigern met his death when it was burned down by Ambrosius and Uther, two brothers who attacked him out of revenge for killing another of their brothers who had been king. For the defenders of Britain, the prophecy of the two dragons was a momentous event, giving hope and inspiration for those who lived in those times to carry on the fight, and it was an important moment in the destiny of Britain, and he went on to make further prophecies concerning the future of Britain beyond Arthur's time. However, as with many other important events in the Arthurian world, the seeds of this event were sown many centuries earlier, before even the Romans ruled, by a king of Britain named Llywelyn Llyw Eraint in the Mabinogion, who in Geoffrey's work is believed to be King Lud. So this is where Merlin features in this, and this is where we get the red dragon of Wales from, that is on the flag, and the white dragon of the Saxons. They apparently had a flag with a white worm on it. This is why you see that the white dragon flag of the Saxons and the red dragon flag of the Cymru, of the Welsh. Truthfeeds, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, so this gave them hope that they would successfully drive out the Anglo-Saxons, right? I did read Geoffrey of Monmouth's that the prophecy of Merlin's massive, right? It's actually several pages long, and you know, just like if you read the Revelation and you've never like truly studied it, it just seems all gibberish until you actually sit down and start looking at certain key events. You'd have to look at certain key events in British history, and then you could start to kind of see it being deciphered. I've never done that. I believe a lot of people have tried, but it was much more extensive than this. It also went into all later kings who would rule over Britain. It even foretells the Normans coming, right? And then eventually the Welsh rising up. That would be that the Henry the Tudor line and gaining dominion back over Britain. But unfortunately, some of the kings started to write their own versions of Merlin and try to abuse it to try and or not just kings, but usurpers, to try and prophesize that they were meant to be king. And that caused a lot of doubt to be thrown over the whole Merlin prophecy, right? But it did seem to foretell the entire history of Britain in the future as well.
Yeah, if you go back to the Brut, the Chronicles of England, it's in there as well. I mean, so it's written in Old English. You can have a look at it written in Old English there. And I should imagine, as you were saying, some of these later kings may have changed it. And that's probably how we know that they changed it, because you can go back and see the originals. And it talks about things such as greyhounds and boars. It's all talking about allegories for different kings and what would happen to Britain. I mean, these prophecies to do with Britain go all the way back to the time of Brutus, with that first prophecy about how there would be the British Empire and how, you know, this kingdom that Brutus would start would last for all time, basically. And here we go. We still have the British kingdom, and it did grow into an empire that took in from where the sun never set. Patriarch, any thoughts on these two dragons and Merlin's prophecies?
Yeah, it's definitely cryptic. And, you know, like something in the book of Revelations, I don't think you can truly understand a lot of the revelations until they've actually happened or are happening. I just wonder if, obviously, since a lot of this prophecy would have transpired now, we must be able to correlate some points. Like, for example, you know, where it says, Britain, which although exhausted and appearing defeated, would eventually rise up and repulse the white dragon of the invading Anglo-Saxons. So is that something that actually happened then? I mean,
that was Arthur. That was Arthur. That was right, Arthur, okay. That defeated them. But then the Saxons
much,
came back.
So that's on point there.
Yeah, I think there's a version of it where the Saxons, like, it chases the red dragon chases the white dragon away, but the white dragon then comes back. And it's the red dragon that runs. I'm sure there's a later side to it. Yeah, it's very cryptic, and it fits in with the Book of Revelation. It's similar to that. And obviously this is where we get the origin of the red dragon flag from, of Wales. And the original flag of the Saxons was a white dragon. And I think they also might have had a raven on a flag. Because they did write about how these flags looked. And Vortigern was the king that invited in Hengist and Horsa And another bit that's interesting about this is that it shows that there were still these pagan ideas at the time, because he was told, because you in order to be able to build this castle here, you have to find this boy, and then you have to, I think it says, sacrifice him and then sprinkle his blood on the earth there. So it shows that there was this pagan idea about human sacrifice that was actually going on. So I'm not quite sure where that fits in, and that obviously would have been a pagan idea. And it makes Vortigern out to be a very, very distasteful king.
Unless the boy was cryptic as well, in some way symbolizing something else, maybe offspring in general, or a generation.
Yeah, that's a good point. It could be. I mean, Merlin himself could be part of the cryptic prophecy. I'll have to have another look at that, actually, because I'm sure when I read it originally, I thought, well, this is strange, because obviously if they're going to sprinkle his blood, you know, they're going to have to do some damage to him. And I can't recall if it was they were actually supposed to kill him, or, you know, drain him of blood or something. It's certainly a very strange episode in British history. I will have to look that up after this episode, I think. Well, getting back to Alan Wilson here now, and he is talking about the Brutes. He says, the Brutes, the official histories of England, state that Arthur would be crowned King of Glamorgan, and Arthur too is provably a Glamorgan king. And the main residence of the Glamorgan kings was at Carmelin, or Carmelot, also known as Cubird, which is Kibber to the Normans, and Cu means mutually together, and Bird means table. A castle stood on this castle field, certainly well into the 15th century, and a wedding is recorded as taking place there in AD 1454. So instead of saying this is by the River Camel in Cornwall, and it must have been Tintagel, they're saying there's actually a castle at Carmelin, which is Carmelot. And this castle stood there well up until the 15th century, and a wedding is recorded as taking place.
Do you know
where
this is, Sven? Glamorgan, is that in Wales somewhere?
Yeah, it's in Glamorgan. You'll have to look it up, Carmelin. I'd have to look it up on the map. I think where I was getting this from, Alan Wilson's book, it's a 40-page PDF on the two King Arthurs, and it also has coordinates of all these places that you can go and have a look at. It has the map coordinates, so you can look them up on an OS map. He doesn't just talk about King Arthur. He talks about all sorts of hidden history and how these place names in Wales were named after these events that actually took place there. So that's what he's saying here. That it's this Carmelin is actually Camelot. And Cubird, Kibber to the Normans means mutually together, and Bird means table. So I wonder if that's talking about the round table there and the Knights of the Round Table. Which is you know, obviously what the Normans are calling it, saying mutually together, and a table where people are mutually together. This second king, named as Arthur, appears on inscriptions and in Cymric texts as Artmall, meaning Iron Bear, and there is no reason to expect an English spelling of his name in a Cymric Welsh text or inscription. So you're not going to actually find the word Arthur in a Welsh text, you'll find Arthmall. This king is copiously recorded, and there can be no doubt that he is the main part of the dual king of Arthurian history and legend. For centuries it was well known that the main king Arthur II of legend was the son of King Maurice Murrig, the son of King Theodoric or Tewdric, the son of King Theodosius or Tethefalt, and Tethfalt, in turn, was the son of Tethryn the Subtle, Theodorus, the son of Tathal, and Theodore, the son of King Arthur I, who was the eldest son of Magnus Clemens Maximus by his first wife Cynric, and several of the most illustrious ancient British manuscripts state this very plainly. So you see the history there, the family tree that goes back to Arthur I. So once you identify who these people are, you can see where they are in these king lists. This Arthur II was born in AD 503 and died in 579. His death, funeral, and burial are copiously recorded. In fact, it is no exaggeration to state that this is the most copiously and accurate funeral in so-called Dark Age European history. It is no exaggeration to say that it is harder to miss than to find. Instead of wasting time and money excavating Greece, Israel, Egypt and elsewhere, the British academics would do far better to try to deal with ancient Britain instead of foreign alien cultures. So, I mean, they're saying once you know that this Arthur is actually Arthmaul, because why would he be called Arthur, which is, you know, the Norman version of his name? His name in Cymric is Arthmaul, and it means Iron Bear. And that's you know, what the name that he was actually known by. Treefids, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I semi-agree with Alan there. Of course, knowing that we came from the East, that it is also important to, you know, excavate like Egypt, for example, to learn of the ancient history of the pharaohs and how it lines up with the Bible of the Middle East, of course, because that's how we discovered all the Assyrians, all their tablets that they called the Israelites Cimmerians or Cymri, not Israelites, after King Omri, and that the Persians called them Sakai and Scythians. And, you know, because we found the stones, Darius's stone, where he you know, writes of his great invasion of Greece, and he wrote it in three different languages. He said, these are the Scythian Sake, and then in the Assyrian language version, he called them the Cimmerians. So it is important to dig up, but I do agree there should certainly be looking at Britain as well and digging up these sites and researching the history. It would be amazing if all of our people knew this, right? But it's astonishing. King Arthur, he would have lived 76 years, right? So when he had that civil war, you basically got this really old king who's 76 fighting against Mordred, right? So you got to realize that maybe that's why he lost, because he was very aged by then. And, you know, a younger nephew who had the local lords, who was younger and more youthful, could best him, right?
That's a very good point. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Well, it's mainly to do with the points I've got to make. It's to do with the general populace of Europe. Kind of, it branches out from kind of from the mainstream perspective, two groups: the Celts, the Gauls, and then there's the Cymri. The Celts and the Gauls are kind of linked at the same time, having come from Galatia, from the east. Like, there's a strong connection between the Galatians and the Celts. So, but from the mainstream perspective, the Gauls migrated eastward to populate Galatia, whereas it should really be the other way around, shouldn't it?
Well, you're making a very good point there, actually, Patriarch, because Alan Wilson and others say that the Cymri were not Celts. And this derivation Celt related to language, and it was before they really knew these differences between these groups when they came out with the word Celtic. So when we use the word Celtic in Britain, we're actually talking about the Cymri. But the Celts and Galatia and Gauls, they were a slightly different group. And the Cymri were a separate group. So, I mean, I think maybe that's what you're referring to there.
Yeah, pretty much. You've got the Germanic line of Celts, which I think more from the kind of the Scythian route and tribes there, kind of going a bit more north around the general Caucasus. And I think that the Celts or the Gauls pretty much migrated through the Caucasus and populating that way. You know, if you want strong connections, at least biblically, from what I've researched so far, there's strong evidence to suggest that the Galatians, for example, were Israelites. And no matter how far they spread, if even a branch of them that populated Galatia were Israelites, that means the rest of them were too, right? Unless it was just culturally, but I'm pretty sure they'd be the same people.
Yeah, and Paul told the Galatians that they were once under the law. So if they are the Gauls and Germanic tribes, then that means everyone, or all of the Europeans, were once under the law, which means we must be descended from the Israelites, right?
Yeah, exactly. And even there's a point which I was reading the other day where it talks about the difference between the being veiled and unveiled, and then it likened the kind of the Judeans, who were under the law and being you know, their vision is veiled. And then it talks about, but the Galatians whose veil is now been lifted. So it's again, assuming status that they once were under a veiled state, but now they've been unveiled. So again, there's lots of kind of nuanced connections in scripture that get completely overlooked and overshadowed just because of a mainstream doctrine, which kind of blinds people.
Yeah, so it goes back to what Truth Is was highlighting earlier. You know, it is worth looking at this evidence out there in the Near East, but we also have to look at the British evidence and tie it in. You know, instead of saying, well, we've got all these enigmas, you know, the Vikings have got Brittonic DNA and we've got this enigma that there were all these roads and there was these ports in Britain in pre-Roman times. Well, the Romans must have been here before Julius Caesar. There can only be the Romans that actually built this port. This vessel here that we have, that must have been the Phoenicians. It couldn't have been the Britons that made this vessel. I mean, Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett, I mean, they even say that the Sutton Hoo helmet can only have been made by the Britons because it features pieces on it that actually go back to Mesopotamia and go back to Assyrian ideas. There's a picture of the man that is wrestling two lions, which goes back to, I forget his name, Gilgamesh. It actually goes back to Gilgamesh. But then from the research that we've seen, which is that the Cimmerians were the same as the Scythians, and the Scythians became the Saxons, and the Saxons came over, and the traditional historians are saying, well, this Sutton Hoo helmet belonged to the Saxons. Well, the Saxons originally had their history going back out to Mesopotamia as well. It's just that the Cimmerians came into Britain first, and perhaps they, you know, held on to it more. They suggest that there is a lot of evidence to show that the Sutton Hoo helmet was a British king rather than a Saxon king. But all of this stuff shows these links to Mesopotamia, and the Gauls, or the Celts and the Cymry, both the same biology, but slightly different groups that are culturally related, but originally they all go back to the same source. And this is moving back to Alan Wilson here. It has to be understood that Christianity arrived in Britain in AD 37, and the early Christians were of different opinions regarding the nature of Jesus the Nazarene. One very large group thought that Jesus was a man when he was born, lived, and died. A second large number thought that he was born and lived as a man, but he became one with God when he died. The third group thought that he was born and lived as one with God and became united so when he died. This means that the incarnation of Jesus the Nazarene was believed by the British to be when he died, and the Romans believed the incarnation dated from when he was born. This is important because the only date given in the Brutes of England is that King Arthur, meaning King Arthur II, died 546 years after the incarnation of the Lord. To the Roman Church, and therefore to the English, this would mean AD 546. To the Cymric Welsh, this would mean 546 plus 33 equals AD 579. This is the correct date for the death of King Arthur II, and all ancient British history is then correct. And that's really interesting, you know, because again, that shows that this Christianity came into Britain at such a very early time, and it had these subtle differences to the Christianity that came later on. And these subtle differences make themselves felt even in the dating of this history. And if you don't know that, then you're going to be out with the history, and you're going to think that the British history is actually out. But that's the reason for it. There was this different understanding of what the incarnation of Christ actually meant. Any thoughts on that, Truefids?
Yeah, it just shows you that Britain was very Christian. But on the dating, I think that's also the same with the Irish history, right? As we said, that because it's, I think it was quite a lot. It was like 500 years out. But if you just make that correction, suddenly it all adds up. And of course, the mainstream historians, you know, some of them probably noticed, but they never mentioned that. And they use these slightly out of date timelines, and they ridicule it to try and say, see, this is all nonsense, you know, and they'll put, you know, this date against Wikipedia date and say, see, it must all be fake history, right?
Yeah, it's scandalous that, that Wikipedia leaves all this information out. And if people put it in there, that they'll either remove it or they won't actually link it, cross-reference it to the other history that's actually there. Patriarch, any thoughts on this and this idea of the incarnation actually happening when at Jesus's death and resurrection rather than actually at his birth?
I think it's well, it goes to show maybe the different perspectives on what they were revering to. Like, it, I think one was obviously leaning more towards a physical birth, and then one was leaning more towards a spiritual birth, almost like being the first, Christ was the first to rise again and conquer death. So maybe that's why they, you know, had it at the end of his life as opposed to the beginning.
Yeah, it's also why.
Yeah, and also if Joseph of Arimathea bought Christianity over straight away, we, as I said before, we don't know how well he understood Christianity, right? Obviously, John and the apostles, they had a great, much greater understanding, especially over the decades. They really started to understand it. So maybe later that started to come to Britain as well. So you'd have these different versions, right?
It's also why, you know, sometimes you will see that King Lucius, the one that was the first person to actually pronounce the British a Christian nation. The British were the first Christian nation, and they were pronounced by King Lucius. Sometimes you'll see that that is written as happening about 140, 150. And in other places, you'll see that that's happening about 170, 180. And this is obviously the reason why, because the history is based upon the it refers to the incarnation, how many years it was after the incarnation. That's what they're dating everything by. And the incarnation is at a different point, according to what we think of today, to what we actually think of then. So that's why you'll see in some places it will say 150, and in other places you'll see that it says 180. So that was new to me when I discovered this, and that explains why there are these different dates. They also say various previously misunderstood dates become correct. One example, Maelgwyn becomes king of Gwynedd in northwest Wales 169 years after Owain Findu. This Owain Findu, or Blackbeard, was a brother of King Arthur I, who died fighting the Irish in AD 434, and Maelgwyn became king of Gwynedd when Arthur II died in AD 579. There are several other dates of this order in the Nennius histories, and they can all be now shown to be very accurate. Owain Findu is still buried in his grave mound at Llanhilleth in Gwent, alongside a church of St. Iltyd, a first cousin of Arthur II. So this, again, Nennius's histories, we get told that, you know, that they can't be correct. But once you realise that there's this 33-year difference in the dates, then Nennius's histories, as they say here, are shown to be very accurate. And we have the proof that these people existed, because you still have this grave mound of this Owain Findu, and he was a brother of King Arthur I. And then you got Maelgwyn, King of Gwynedd, when Arthur II died. So that's all in the history. And once you understand this and who these people are, you'll find that there's lots of evidence for them, unlike what the mainstream will tell us. Any thoughts on this, Truefids? And any thoughts on the whole episode today? Because I think we should probably finish in a minute.
Yeah, I just find it astonishing the sheer amount of time and you know Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett put into all this, like looking at the graves. That must have took forever, right? Traveling all over Wales and England, looking and researching it. I'm sure they didn't get it right the first time. Every time they'd have to keep going to different churches, and then maybe they'd come across something, go back and you know, have another look. But it's amazing all the effort, and I really applaud all their efforts in putting this. So I'm so glad that we can bring it up and let other people know, right? Because Alan Wilson's very old now, but we can still keep his material alive and let other people, you know, read into it.
Well, they devoted their whole lives to it. And so much of this is based on the old Welsh and old Welsh translations. Welsh used to be written in a slightly different way to how it is today. And they look at the maps and they see that these places that were named after these characters, And then you can work, you know, there's so many places that are actually named after the battles that King Arthur had. There are places in Wales that are named after King Constantine. There are places that are named after Empress Helen when she carried the cross across. You know, you've got place names in Britain, Wales, that are named after these old places in the Old Testament, you know, and it must have come. It must have come from all of this. Yeah, it's the amount of work that they actually put into this. They devoted their whole lives to it, and they've really suffered for it as well. You know, there was a bomb, like the house got blown up. They've had people accuse them of taking artifacts from their own place. I mean, they bought this plot of land because they knew that there was an old church under it, and they bought the plot of land. It was their plot of land, and then of course there was this church that was under it, so whatever was in that, you know, belonged to them. But somebody called the police on them. They've had all sorts of issues with the authorities and the mainstream historians that don't want this stuff to be discussed. Patriarch, any thoughts on this and final thoughts for today?
Yeah, it's been really insightful, this series, to really dig deep into our kind of history. And yeah, it's a testament to, you know, their hard work, and you know, I'm grateful for this series really being able to give it a more of a platform, and hopefully others will tune in the future, and it can kind of set in stone a lot of their works for people in future generations to kind of come and you know, serve as a platform for additional research, basically, because I think we'll probably need this in the coming generations, really, when things get really hard. I think it's one of the most important messages to really understand the true roots and you know, of our people, and especially when you know, our history is being kind of washed over by kind of lies and deception.
You have to understand where you've come from to where you're going, and I think this series we're doing really does fulfill the title, doesn't it? It really is a patriotic history. That's the way that we are looking at this. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Truefids.
Thanks for having me. As always a pleasure, Sven.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thanks a lot.
And thank you very much, listeners, for listening. And we will be back next week with another episode of Patriotic History. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.